Welcome to the official SBGAN podcast, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely.
Hey there. Your SBGAN podcast team are collecting, as always, expertise from as many learned, skilled, and experienced pediatric gastroenterologists and hepatologists as possible. And among them, wait just a moment, I can't forget dietitians. They're clearly one of the most important links in the chain between gastroenterologists and the universal goal, a healthy child and a happy family. Today, we're having the chance to meet Dr. Ellen Malmberg-Hortov-Segerstadt. Now, that is a mouthful, but the Hortov-Segerstadt family has a 500-year tradition of accomplishment as military men, as skilled professionals, architects. One of our guests' great uncles built half the municipal buildings in Helsingfors, here in Finland, as it happens. And even today, one of them's an accomplished songwriter. We'll hear a little bit more about that later, perhaps. However, Ellen, may I call you Ellen?
Yes,
you may. Ellen has turned her attention and her efforts to the origins and management of the immune dysfunction, dysregulation, that is manifest as celiac disease.
Yes, they are.
In a person with an inherited susceptibility to celiac disease, what triggers development of the clinical phenotype? Well, we're not done. I've got a whole list of questions that I want to press you on. If we can find the triggers, can we avoid them? How can we avoid them? After diagnosis and treatment, how can we monitor a patient with celiac disease to make sure that he or she isn't being naughty? And who is best positioned to monitor such patients? So, three questions then, really, as a framework on which to build our discussion, please. What role does diet play in the development of celiac disease in children? Can dietary modifications prevent celiac disease? How can gluten-free diet adherence be best assessed in children with celiac disease? How does clinical practice at the moment fall short in this regard? What is the role of the dietitian in the management of celiac disease in children? Should all children with celiac disease have access to an experienced dietitian? I know that that's six questions, but we'll double up and call them three. And when you take a look at the cover note for this podcast, you'll find three articles that Ellen has found important and worth sharing with us. So, where do you want to start?
Where do you want to start?
We start at the beginning, yes. We go to the end, and then yes. We stop.
Yeah.
How about that?
That sounds good.
Yeah. Right. Diet and the development of celiac disease and identification of triggers.
Yes. Let's start there.
I have to turn this over to you at some point. Just tell us what they are.
So this has been an ongoing question since the start of the 90s, uh-huh, with the Swedish celiac epidemics, where we had many children developing celiac disease in an early age, and it co-occurred with changes in the general dietary recommendations in all children. And then pediatricians started thinking about, could there be a link between these dietary changes and this increased incidence of celiac disease?
Fascinating. There was an experiment of nature.
Yes, it was. Uh-huh. But since then, we've learned a lot about the role of the diet, because by then, it was thought that maybe there's a window of opportunity when gluten should be introduced in the diet. So what's the appropriate age? And it was also thought that maybe breastfeeding had something to do with this, that it would be protective and that the gluten should be introduced at the same time as the breastfeeding was still ongoing. But with the evidence that came out, all the research that came out with that, we found out that those were not actually the causes of this rise in incidence. So we're still doing research to trying to figure out the role of diet, of different nutritional factors in the etiology of celiac disease.
Did this wave subside?
Yes, it did. When the government changed their recommendations back to what it was before again, and then the incidence dropped.
I can't let you get away without telling us what the differences were.
Yeah. So the differences were what age you introduced gluten into the child diet. Before the epidemic, it was at starting around 4 months of age. And then during the epidemics, it was at 6 months of age. But the breastfeeding rates also dropped, which meant that the children, they were eating something else. They were not breastfeeding, but they were getting something else. And that was, we have a very peculiar type of infant drink in the Scandinavian countries, mostly in Sweden, which is it's a infant cereal, but you take it in a bottle. And Swedish children were consuming a lot of that. And that has gluten in it. And the more recent research in observational studies in the more recent years have been looking at the amount of gluten that children are getting in their diet in early life. And there we see the data is pointing towards that. It might be that when children are getting large amount of gluten in their diets in the early years of life, and not just in infancy, in that first year of life, but maybe even in the first 2 or 3 years of life, that's what contributes to this increased risk.
So the more gluten over a more prolonged period of time conduces to frank celiac disease.
Well, this is just one part of the story, and still we only have observational data. But coming from different cohorts from both Europe and the US, but still we don't have enough clinical data, clinical trials actually showing that if you reduce the amount or if you modify the amount of gluten in the child's diet, then you modify the risk of celiac disease. Those studies are ongoing, so we will know in the future if this. So still, when we last year wrote the position paper coming from the special interest group in celiac disease on these early life diet and the risk of celiac disease, we can still not conclude that children should be eating less gluten.
I know that to reason by analogy is treacherous, and perhaps it's even more treacherous than usual in immunology and allergology.
Yeah.
But hasn't there been some recent work that demonstrates that introduction of peanuts early is good, is protective?
Yeah.
And here we have a different food substance in which introduction of wheat early may be deleterious.
Yeah, so this here we might see the big differences between food allergies and celiac disease and the different mechanisms. So there has been clinical trials looking into this, the introduction, the slow introduction and controlled introduction of gluten in the diet of infants, and looking at different ages when gluten is introduced. But these clinical trials showed that wasn't the case. It wasn't, it didn't affect the risk of celiac disease. So it's very interesting in the food allergy area that you can modify the risk, but still we're not there yet with celiac disease. And probably there could be other factors.
Almost certainly there are other factors. So we're not quite to the stage of even identifying the triggers for development.
Mm.
And of course, as a corollary, we're not in the position successfully to avoid triggers.
Not yet. So we, in the field of celiac disease, we know that you have to have certain genetic predisposition, and there are indications that infections and different pathogens may be contributing. So when it comes to diet, it might not be that the diet is the actual trigger of the celiac disease, but it might be an infection or prolonged infections or several infections, but things, different factors happening at the same time. So diet may be more of a contributor, a mediator maybe, but still we in the celiac research field, I think that we are agreeing that there are probably many factors happening at the same time in these children.
This is all, again, almost as a layperson, but I do remember some speculation that the ultra-clean environment in which children nowadays are raised conduces, again, to an increase in susceptibility to immune dysregulation. In other words, if you grow up on a farm eating dirt all the time, then nothing phases you when you get to be older.
Yeah. So we're not quite there yet to explain. So there's certainly a lot of research going on the microbiota of children. Also indications pointing towards that direction, but we still don't know what happens before children get celiac disease and whether there are differences. We just published from our group very recently that high fiber diet in children seems to actually be lowering the risk. So it goes a little bit along that line. You know, fibers are the foods for the gut bacteria, and it promotes diversification and the composition of the microbiota. So that's partly in line with that hypothesis, but still it's too early to know the role.
Mm. Well, let's shift gears just a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay. And after diagnosis and treatment, then compliance.
Yes.
I wonder if kids with celiac disease, like kids with hereditary fructosemia, aren't in some ways self-monitoring to induce compliance. If I eat this, it makes me feel bad. So with fructosemia, I stay away from this and that.
Yeah, that would be maybe a dream scenario, but that's not the case.
A boy can dream in it. A boy can dream.
That's not the case in celiac disease. The dietary adherence in celiac disease is really, really tricky because definitely not all children or adolescents experience symptoms when they eat gluten. So you cannot trust the symptoms. Definitely there are those who experience immediate symptoms, like after an hour or so after ingesting gluten, but it can differ from time to time. And very small amounts of gluten can trigger an immune response, and without necessarily causing symptoms. So this is a whole area of a big, big challenge within the management of celiac disease, where it's very important to avoid complications and long-term complications from celiac disease, to be strict with the diet, but we have not enough good objective tools how to assess the dietary adherence. And it's not a disease that you can self-monitor.
I don't know where I came across this. Maybe it was just in doing a quick PubMed of your recent work.
Yeah.
But did you recommend to me your Journal of Nutrition paper?
Maybe not.
No, I don't think you did. And I think that's very naughty of you. Because here we have, I'm going to read the title now for our audience, Plasma Alkyl Resorcinols, an Objective Biomarker for Gluten Intake in Young Children.
Yeah.
Now, when you can get that into a spit test or a urine test, you know, well, I just want to buy the patent rights now.
Yeah, there are already some other markers of gluten intake that has been researched. Also, recently, the GIPs, gluten peptides, you can measure them in stools and urine. But still, it doesn't, and it's the same with the plasma alkyl resorcinols, that it's not a good marker for maybe for a long-term gluten intake. And it doesn't differ between, okay, you can see large amounts of gluten intake, but we're interested in these small amounts.
The cheaters, so. The one cookie won't hurt kids.
Huh? Yes, and we cannot really detect those in the proper way. So this is still a challenge. But the plasma alkyl resorcinols, it's something that has been used a lot for as a biomarker for whole grain intake, because you'll find them in the bran of both wheat and and rye, which are gluten-containing grains. But we found that you could also use them as a measure of gluten intake.
Mm. Well, I'm a little bit disappointed that we haven't found the magic bullet, but it'll come. It will come.
Hopefully.
Well, we've touched on many of the points that we hoped to address during our chat. Have I left anything out? Is there anything on that you'd like to amplify?
Yeah, so the role of the dietitian in the follow-up care and the management of celiac.
Trust
disease.
Me to forget that. Yes. Okay. Yes. So go on. What do you see? Now, you laughed at me because I had a dream. Okay. In this regard, what is your dream?
My dream is that every child that has celiac disease will have proper follow-up with a clinical dietitian, and not just once, but continuous follow-up and education by an experienced and trained dietitian throughout their childhood and adolescence. Because having celiac disease, which is a complicated medical disease, which is only managed by a dietary therapy, you need that continuous education and personalization, individualization in this therapy. How will this diet work best for you? What are your challenges? And the dietitian will help with that.
Right. Now, that may be accessible, that may be available in what one thinks of as well-managed societies, such as the Scandinavian countries. What's the situation? Is that actually the situation, or?
No, it doesn't seem to be the situation. And I would say also in Scandinavian countries, it's not the situation.
Uh-huh.
This happens all over, that children might meet a dietitian for the initial education, for the initial consultation on how to do the gluten-free diet. But this continuous follow-up and getting to ask all of their questions when they grow up, when they turn into adolescents and they eat, you know, outside of the house, and how to properly manage
this. And they become invulnerable,
Yeah, and they have to work on their autonomy. So this is not happening. There was a big survey some years ago that the special interest group in celiac disease in Espgan led, and they asked, it was about 900 physicians all across Europe, and it showed that there were a lot of units across Europe that didn't have access to dietitians at all, and that you didn't routinely refer your celiac patients to dietitians.
Well, to be regretted, and as awareness of the contribution of dietitians and dietetic science to patient management and to better results increases, perhaps funding and personnel will be arranged. One can only hope.
We have shown from our unit that having a dietitian to do the follow-up, it's cost-effective compared to a physician doing it. And it's a safe clinical practice. And the dietitian can play a big role in helping with the dietary adherence and nutritional intake. So it really makes a difference.
Good to know, good to hear. And unfortunately, it's also time for goodbye, or almost time for goodbye.
Thank you very much for having me.
I keep on telling you, I'm not done with you yet.
Oh.
And I'm not done with you now because you haven't yet told us which song that speaks to you that somehow reflects you and a little bit of Sweden. You want to contribute to the Espigan favorite songs list available on Spotify.
Yeah. So I choose Heroes, which was a song that won the Eurovision Song Contest some years ago from Sweden. And actually, my brother co-wrote that song. So personally, for me, it's a favorite. And it speaks to all of the ESPGAN members and everyone working in pediatrics out there, and also our patients. We're all heroes.
Thanks so much.